Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. This is a Literary Studies podcast, and I'm Natalia, one of the hosts on the channel. Today I will be speaking with Dr. David Goldstein. David Goldstein and his colleague Amy Tigner edited a collection of essays, Culinary Shakespeare, Staging Food and Drink in Early Modern England. Hello, David.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me here.
Before we discuss the collection of essays, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm a professor of English at York University in Toronto, in Canada. And I work on several different areas of literature, including Shakespeare, which is what my dissertation is in, Shakespeare and Renaissance studies, contemporary poetry. I'm also a poet. And food studies. And most of my focus also, I also work on ecology. And most of my focus for the last several years in my research has been trying to figure out the links between literary studies, food studies, and ecology and eco-criticism. So this book comes directly out of that that thinking.
So your interests are kind of interdisciplinary.
Exactly, yes.
So before we discuss the collection, would you tell us a little bit about this interdisciplinary approaches to literature at the contemporary stage? Because it's kind of a very popular trend.
Yes. When I first got interested in food, it was as an undergraduate. And my advisor, I had a wonderful advisor who said, you know, you probably shouldn't go into food studies because they'll think of you as the food guy and you'll be forced into this interdisciplinary situation. And whereas you want to be serious, you want to show yourself to be a real literary scholar. So I said, okay. And I started planning all sorts of dissertation ideas around originality and translation, which I'm also very interested in. But at that point, that was very clear that that was literary studies. And then about halfway through my PhD, my advisor in my PhD said, you know what? Why don't you do food? You love it. You're excited about it. Interdisciplinarity is all the rage. It'll be great. So in those few years between undergrad and grad, the climate had really shifted around interdisciplinarity. And I'm very happy that it has moved in that direction because I think, you know, the whole point of literary studies is it's about life. It's about culture. It's about the way in which we operate in all areas of our world. And what literature does is produce a kind of imaginative map of that world. It enters into the realm of the imagination and connects it to the realm of reality. So if you're not talking about everything, then you're not giving literature its full due. So I think literature is always automatically interdisciplinary. And specifically, food studies is a category of experience that has only recently begun to be taken seriously as something that, hey, you know, we do it every day. You know, if we're lucky, if we're in a privileged place, we'll, you know, encounter food probably at least three times a day, probably more. And that very fact of the quotidian interaction between ourselves and our world through food has got to be important, and it's got to be able to be theorized in intelligent ways, and not just by scientists, but also by people who think about the imagination and how we relate to it. So I think literary studies is perfectly poised to enter that realm of interdisciplinarity. I just, my fear is that, you know, as with any trend, it kind of gets pumped up and then it disappears. And this, I think, is not... The relationship between literature and food studies is not just a passing fad. It's a really deep issue. If you look into any era of literary history, you find writing that is very passionately concerned with our relationship to our own bodies through eating and through our environment, through what we eat and how we eat it. So I would hope that this wouldn't be something that would just fade out. Now that I sort of happen to have stumbled on it when it's just getting hot, I don't want it to suddenly cool off. So hopefully it won't.
Yeah.
It'll remain serious.
Yeah, but for decades, it was kind of a cliche. When we talk about literature, we're talking about some aesthetic issues. But on the other hand, truth is also some sort of aesthetic engagement as well. And I think that your collection demonstrates that very well. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about how this project originated. Was it your initial interest in culinary Shakespeare, or maybe some other culinary interests preceded that this project?
Well, they definitely happened simultaneously. My co-editor, Amy Tigner, is a classmate of mine from graduate school. And when we were in our first year of graduate school, I actually can't remember. I think she was in the, I think we both took a class on food studies. It was the first one that had been offered in the English department at Stanford. And, if she wasn't in that class, then we were certainly talking about these issues together immediately. Her interest in her dissertation was in gardening and the environment. And you can see how gardening can easily turn into cookery. She became interested in what happens when you take the garden and you bring it into the kitchen. So for years, we had been talking about our shared interests in food, and she was also a Shakespearean, so our ideas really developed together. Our interest in women's writing, we're both very strongly interested in recipes and how early modern women worked as writers and how we can think of them and theorize them as part of the literary tradition. After we had both sort of, you know, finished our books and were moving on to the next project, our first books, we started talking about running panels and seminars together at conferences that might explore the intersection between Shakespeare and food a little more directly. So we put together a couple of panels and a couple of seminars at major conferences in our field and started sort of collecting a group of scholars who were interested in this topic and who were contributing to it. And after a couple of years of that, it seemed like the right time to put together a collection. So we asked those scholars and many others if they were interested in contributing to such a collection, because none exists. There's one collection about food in the Renaissance more broadly, and there are others about food in history that may have one chapter on the Renaissance, but nothing about Shakespeare. And every single play of Shakespeare's deals with food in some way. And there has been lots of really interesting writing about it, but it hadn't sort of reached a critical mass. It hadn't reached the point where you could say, okay, this is a field, this is a topic, or a subfield at least, and this is worth exploring by a larger group of scholars in a more concerted way. So we thought, well, hopefully if we do a volume like this, that will be one impetus for scholars to really see it as a subfield that they can take seriously.
Well, the structure of the collection demonstrates how conspicuous the topic of food is, and actually it also demonstrates how many dimensions food permeates. So, for example, there are three parts in this collection. The first one is local and global. The second one, body and state. And the third one, theater and community. And even the structure itself demonstrates the connection and the interconnection of those multiple dimensions which food actually permeates. Would you make a couple of comments on this structure and on this conspicuous presence of food in this collection, and probably, well, you already mentioned a couple of words about food and Shakespeare's plays, but maybe some more information about that.
Sure. It's funny you mentioned the structure, because we went back and forth about how to structure the book for a long time, and our initial instinct was to structure it as a meal: appetizers, main course, dessert, that kind of thing. And that sort of ended up in a vestigial way in the fact that the last essay is a kind of capstone afterword type essay called Room for Dessert, which does sort of tie everything together in a dessert-like way. But we quickly discovered that, you know, I mean, it's a cliche to organize writing about food as if it is a meal. Mm-hmm. And I'm always a little suspicious of that, because writing about food does something different from the ways in which meals are actually structured. It stands apart from them and analyzes them in different ways. So we were both happy to move a little bit away from that and think instead about the ways that food kind of circulates in society, the many different ways in which we interact with food. We think of food as an object, as a substance that's on our plates that was originally an animal or a plant in the ground or on the ground, or et cetera. And then we have a sort of one-way relationship with it, right? The food, the creature appears on our plate, we eat it, it goes into our body, it's excreted, we're done, we move on to the next one. Whereas in fact, food is less, I think, an object than it is a relationship. It's a way of articulating and experiencing in a kind of physical, material way our relationship to other people through the table, through meal interactions, things like that, to the animals and plants around us, to the environment, to ideas about our relationship to other things and animals and people. So it's much more sort of much more complex and fluid than thinking about food as a singular object. And a lot of wonderful scholars have written about this, that we should really start pushing ourselves more to think about eating rather than food, to think about the act and the interactions therein than the physical fact of the thing on our plates. So we tried to suggest that that's what Shakespeare is also doing in those headings and in those groupings, that really the first three chapters of the book are focused very much on questions of trade, questions of consumerism, of interaction between England and other countries, nation states, and as well as other kinds of groups. So it made sense to think of that as a kind of, even as a kind of colonial and post-colonialist category. So we called it local and global because all of these are interested in a sort of national and international way in which food traces various roots and connections. And then we also noticed that there was a group of essays that was coalescing under the question of how the individual body is related to the larger cultural paradigm in which that body sits. So in other words, the relationship between us as individuals and our larger group and community, our state, our nation. And so it seems to make sense to think about that group as talking through ways in which the body and the culture, or the body and the state, operate, sometimes in tandem and sometimes antagonistically, as is always the case in Shakespeare. And we've also found, certainly in our own research and also in the research that these wonderful scholars in this collection have discovered, that whenever Shakespeare talks about food, he's always also talking about theater. Everything, you know, everything in Shakespeare's plays is in some ways a meta-commentary on the theater itself. And food is no exception. In fact, food is one of the hallmark ways in which Shakespeare thinks about theater, because the banquet itself, the meal itself, is a form of theater, and it always has been. It is a performance. So Shakespeare's fascinated by either creating banquets on stage, as he does possibly most famously or most obviously in Macbeth, where in the middle of the play, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth stage this grand banquet that's going to sort of consolidate their power. And instead of that happening, Macbeth starts seeing Banquo's ghost sit down at the table. He freaks out. Lady Macbeth has to kind of cover everything up and then gets angry at him afterwards. And you know that that's the beginning of the end for the Macbeths at that point. So banquets usually play a really important theatrical role in the ways in which Shakespeare's plays are structured. And even if there aren't banquets on stage, there are lots of references to banquets in a lot of the plays. So we thought it made sense to kind of close the book by thinking about the way in which Shakespeare thinks about the relationship between theater and food and eating and drinking. So theater and community sort of was the natural way of connecting those last essays.
So I believe you state somewhere, it's in the introduction, and I believe that was page 3, there was a statement, for Shakespeare, the culinary is primary. Could you decipher that statement for us?
Sure. In some ways, it's a bit of a radical statement if you look at the history of Shakespeare criticism, which tends to relegate food to the background. But that's because the history of criticism in general tends to relegate food to the background and to think about food as a kind of secondary, less important thing. I think this actually goes all the way back to Plato, where Plato says in the Gorgias, the Gorgias, Socrates is debating with his interlocutors, and he says, you know, can't we agree that eating and drinking are sort of, you know, gross bodily things, that what we should really be focusing on is philosophy? And everybody says, oh, yeah, Socrates, we agree with you. And that theme is throughout Plato and to a lesser extent in Aristotle. And I think that all of Western culture has taken that as a cue to think of food as a kind of secondary, oh, we wish we didn't have to do that all the time, so that we could just spend our lives thinking. It's really about the great mind-body dualism that we've been spending a lot of time talking about for the last, I don't know, 50 years or so. And only recently, as that dualism has been reevaluated over the, you know, over the past several decades, have we started to think of food as a more serious and fundamental and theorizable, you know, as philosophically important category in our lives. And so I think, you know, Shakespeare Studies is always interested in trying to figure out how to take what's in the cultural air and relate it to Shakespeare. And I think this is one of those cases where the relationship actually turns out to be very clear, that while for many years we've been thinking, oh, food, that's the secondary thing in Shakespeare, when you start to look, every Shakespeare play has characters talking directly about food, about eating, tons and tons of culinary metaphors throughout all the plays. Often there's food staged in the plays, although interestingly, there's less staged food in Shakespeare than there is in some of his contemporaries, like Ben Jonson, for example. Because of that, even when critics who are very serious about looking at food in the plays talk about food, they tend to sort of say, well, Shakespeare's not as interested in this as, say, Jonson is or Middleton. So Shakespeare tends to be seen as secondary, but in fact, again, once you start looking at these plays, you start to see all sorts of interesting ways of thinking through the question of food in the plays and the question of eating, also of drinking. And in fact, there are several essays in the book that at least touch on, circle around, and two of them directly talk about Falstaff in the Henry IV plays and the way in which Falstaff is identified so completely in our cultural imagination with drinking, with being a drunkard. He loves his sack. He has these beautiful paeans to sack, these lovely speeches about how wonderful sack is, and sack is a kind of imported wine in the period. And people tend to gloss over that, but in fact, you know, and they think about that as just an adjunct to his character. But if you think of it as a major part of his character, then, as some of the critics in this volume have shown, you start to open up all sorts of interesting questions about trade, about addiction, about the relationship between drinking and speaking, about the relationship between drunkenness and festivity and theater. And it turns out that that material phenomenon and metaphor of sack is absolutely crucial to the way that Henry IV plays think of themselves and think of, you know, build themselves through their characters.
So this collection presents food as an element that participates in the construction of the individuality or of the individual. but it also connects food to the construction of the nation. And some essays tie food to Englishness or to the nationality, nationhood construction, or fluidity to some extent as well. So could you tell us a little bit more about this connection between food and the national and the political, and food and the nation construction?
Sure, yeah. It's I think there's a very deep connection between food and nationhood. And several of the critics, not just the ones in part two, also in part one, I think, draw this out, because I think it's very central that people are going to think about identifying themselves in relation to the food they eat, and then in a kind of national relationship too. And I think in contemporary terms, we talk a lot about the ways in which, for example, immigrant groups keep some of the things that they hold on to most tightly are their culinary traditions, and they associate them very strongly with the places that they've come from or been displaced from. Shakespeare is also working within that kind of national context in which food is very closely related to nation, but sometimes in surprising ways. So in the lead essay in the volume, Peter Parolin writes about, and this is Henry IV again, he's not writing about Falstaff, he's writing about Prince Hal, who becomes King Henry V, and thinking about how Hal seems very concerned about the question of what he drinks. And what he drinks is small beer, which is this cheap beer. And beer is actually originally a Dutch import into Britain, although, of course, we now think of beer as being iconically British. But it also has a history, and it's a history of transformation and fluidity and movement. And so the way in which Hal thinks about his relationship to beer is a very complex one, and has all sorts of things to do with his feelings about what it's going to mean for him to take over as king, when in fact he's been a kind of rebellious, you know, prodigal son kind of kid who's hanging out with all these tough guys and lower classes, and everyone has sort of, his father has written him off as someone who might not be able to assume the kingship. And the way in which he talks about beer and other foodstuffs kind of negotiates between his relationship with the lower classes and his relationship with kingship and the monarchy. So it's all about how he places himself in terms of a British identity, not just an individual mm-hmm. identity. Mm-hmm.
I was particularly fascinated by one of the articles, and that article was discussing oranges in Shakespeare's. Yeah. I can't see that essay right now.
That's chapter 3. That's Peter Canalosa's So Many Strange Dishes, Food, Love, and Politics, and Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah, and I was fascinated by this approach that highlights the shifting boundaries between the local and the international, the local and the foreign, and where the Englishness actually is presented in the light of shifting nature.
Yeah, that's a very interesting essay too, because rather than just think about how food interacts in the British context, he's pointing out that there's also an Italian context mm-hmm. for food that Shakespeare is also sensitive to, and this certainly happens in other plays as well. So he's very interested in the fact that oranges keep showing up in Much Ado About Nothing in ways that don't seem to be necessary. They don't seem to be motivated by the text. There seems an extra focus on oranges, and why is that? And so he traces oranges back through Sicily and through North Africa, which is where Britain was getting many of its oranges from, if not all. Well, they could grow oranges in Britain, but it was a real novelty. Most oranges came from Spain, from Sicily from North Africa. And the way in which oranges, he shows, gets used in Much About Nothing has Much Ado About Nothing has a lot to do with the way in which foreignness is mobilized and thought about in that play, and the relationship between the Italian context and the British audience is sort of thought through on the level of the culinary as well as on the level of the political and cultural and psychological.
So early in the conversation, you mentioned that a table can be considered as a stage itself, and kitchen itself can be presented as a stage itself. So in this light, food can be presented as a kind of a bridge between the actual life and between the play, between the audience and between the characters. And again, there is this collaboration of the audience and the characters, of the audience and the playwright himself.
Yeah, very much. I think that banqueting and meal time, the staging of meals in both Shakespeare and all of his fellow playwrights, really is a way of staging how a community forms itself and tries to sort of maintain itself both within its own boundaries and how it creates boundaries with others. And I think that boundaries with others is also an important part in the sense that I think we in modern culture may idealize meals a little bit by thinking there's lots of research, very good research on how family meals contribute to psychological stability and all sorts of things. And yes, there's no question that that meals as basic cultural and psychological units, as interactions, are extremely important for humans, and they have been for thousands of years. It's one of the things we do best, is sit around and eat together, which is very rare for other animals. But there's also, of course, that dark side to eating together, which is that whenever one community is formed, another community is kept out, right? So who's not invited to the table? And this question of who's not invited, or who is invited with a kind of sinister, ulterior motive, is very present in Shakespeare's plays, especially obviously in the tragedies, but even in the comedies. So one of the articles that I think draws this out very nicely is Douglas Lanier's article called Cynical Dining and Timon of Athens, where he talks about what he calls the kind of humanist banquet tradition, which other scholars have elaborated very beautifully. Michel Généret in French wrote about the way in which the humanist banquet takes shape in the centuries leading up to Shakespeare. And Lanier talks about how the humanist version of this banquet is a very positive one and a very sort of harmonious place in which both the intellect and the culinary aspects, the material aspects of the body, are fed. Shakespeare gets a hold of that humanist banquet metaphor and tears it apart. He's very, I think of Shakespeare as a deeply skeptical writer. And so anything that he gets from humanism that seems to be positive, he's going to pick apart and analyze and see what's going on with it. So Lanier shows how in Titus Andronicus, in The Taming of the Shrew, and finally in Timon of Athens, Shakespeare takes this model of the banquet and turns it in such a way that it shows as much the divisiveness within a community and the kind of antagonisms that appear between characters and between ideologies, between political motivations, and between basic philosophical points of view, as it does help to sort of form a community. And although he focuses on Timon of Athens, ultimately I'm actually writing an article now that's somewhat based on his Lanier's work about Taming of the Shrew, in which that play is so interesting because it creates all sorts of divisions through food, but it also ends with a banquet that tries to pull the community together. So the banquet has this kind of double function of breaking apart and possibly healing. And I think that's the only, well, there are other plays of Shakespeare's in which he meditates on sort of both sides, the double-edged quality of the banquet and feasting.
So speaking about those who are invited to the table and those who are not, we can also talk about those who are remembered and those who are forgotten. So, and food also participates in this memory projects. And there is one essay that actually talks about this connection between food and memory. I think that's part three, chapter eight, Feasting and Forgetting. So, Would you just make a couple of comments about food and memory in terms not only remembering, but in terms of forgetting as well?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a wonderful essay by Tobias Doering about Twelfth Night and the way in which Twelfth Night conjures various sorts of food and drink, such as pickled herring. But there are lots of foodstuffs in Twelfth Night, both in order to create memorial connections and also in a strange way to erase things and to forget things. One thing, I mean, when we think about food and memory, we often think about sort of our deep connections to childhood, right? Food can bring up such powerful memories of eating those foods when we were kids and also, as I was saying, sort of, we were talking about national connections and immigrant connections to food of one's native country, perhaps. So there are lots of ways in which food is seen to be really deeply connected with memory. But we're also talking, when we talk about eating, we're also talking about drinking. And one of the whole points of drinking in modern society, and, you know, by modern, I mean going back hundreds of years, is to forget, is, you know, you drink yourself into oblivion. Mm-hmm. You drink in order to forget your problems and just be happy and festive. So there's also that side of consumption that we don't really think about those two things together, that food taken broadly as eating and drinking, both is about remembering and about forgetting. And what Doering does in that essay, which is so lovely, is think about the ways in which this maps on to religious ideologies of the period. It's certainly been discussed at length that Twelfth Night has a lot to do with thinking about a Catholic past for England, right? That England, by the time Shakespeare is writing, is entirely Protestant. And by entirely, I mean the government is Protestant. But of course, there are lots of Catholics still in England. There are lots of Catholic traditions that are kind of holdovers. In some ways, the theater itself is a Catholic tradition, since in Shakespeare's childhood, he would have seen Corpus Christi cycle plays, medieval morality plays that would have been based very much on a Catholic way of approaching the question of religious belief, and that gets phased out or stamped out depending on which context you're talking about. And then is sort of replaced by the professional theater. So even the body of the theater itself somehow has this kind of Catholic remnant in it. And what Doering shows is that Twelfth Night kind of goes back and forth between soliciting that Catholic past and reminding us of it, and then denying it and forgetting it and sort of erasing it, pushing it away, and does so through these festive acts of eating and drinking. So it can really cut both ways. That's one of the, you know, when I was talking about food and drink, the culinary being so fluid, that's partly what I mean, is that it can take on all sorts of roles within a society.
So culinary representations in Shakespeare are really fascinating, but would you say that they are available for staging?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, from a directorial perspective, staging banquets and eating is one of the most interesting things to do in a play, right? I mean, I find whenever I see a production of Macbeth, for example, mm-hmm. what's most interesting, or one of the most interesting things, is seeing how the banquet is staged. And I saw a recent production where the The banquet was left on stage during the intermission, and the witches picked over it while people were milling about and sort of popping grapes in their mouth and things. So there's a really visceral aspect to food that can be very interesting. But of course, it's also dangerous because actors don't want to have to do things that they can't fully control. And putting food in your mouth, obviously you can't talk while you're eating. So you have to block that out in some way. But also, you know, who knows? You can cough, you can choke. There are all sorts of, questions and variables that come up when you actually integrate food into staging. But I think that's more than offset by the fact that in theater, we want an experience that feels real, that feels immediate. And there are very few things that feel more immediate than watching an actor eat on stage or drink on stage. You're so aware of their body. You're so aware of their physicality in space, and you become aware of your own physicality as well. And I think that's one of the reasons why Shakespeare and his contemporaries are so interested in eating and drinking, because it does place the body in a kind of forcibly material context in relationship to the audience. So I think it's wonderful for directors. And often I see directors put food in where there actually isn't any in the script. And I think that's, you know, they have people eat where there are no directions to eat. And I would do that too if I were directing these plays.
So what Shakespeare's play offers the most lavish engagements with food? I know that we can find food probably in every single one, but just to have the taste of Shakespeare's play in terms of culinary engagements, which one would you recommend?
Oh, I don't know. They're almost all of them have mm-hmm. so much in them. Mm-hmm. And to tell you the truth, for whatever reason, whatever dark reason in my soul, I get attracted to the ones that are the most negative mm-hmm. aspects of portrayals of food. The one in some ways I'm most interested in, although in some ways it has very little eating in it, is The Merchant of Venice, which is a play that stages a deep conflict between Jews and Christians, partly around the question of food. Mm-hmm. People don't necessarily always notice that when Shylock is first introduced, he's one of the first things that Bassanio, one of the Christian characters, asks Shylock is, will he come to figure out the details of their business agreement over dinner? And Shylock responds, no, there's no way, I'm not going to eat with you. And the implication is that it's because Shylock keeps kosher, so he's not going to sit at a Christian table. Now, the fact that Shakespeare's audience would have gotten that reference and would have understood what the kosher laws were and what kept Christians and Jews apart at the table seems to me really interesting. But what's even more interesting is the fact that lots of meals are talked about during the play, but never staged. So you hear about people going to meals with each other. Shylock does end up going to a meal with Bassanio, which is really weird since he said he wouldn't. And all sorts of other characters say, oh, let's have a meal. And then somebody says, you know, somebody declines it or says no. Other meals happen off stage. So there's all this constant talking about food. There are all these references to pork and to doves. There's a dish of doves on the stage. But how do you stage a dish of doves? Like, that's not like biting into an apple. That's a kind of weird thing to put on the stage. So I just find the play endlessly strange around the question of food. It's not comfortable. None of it is comfortable. But clearly Shakespeare is so interested in using food to get at all of these things that are deeply uncomfortable in the play. And I think the play is one of Shakespeare's most disturbing in the sense that very little is resolved, very little is seen to be okay. There are all these emotions that are never sort of understood fully, even by the characters themselves. And how fascinating that Shakespeare's using food to kind of enter into all those questions. So I guess I would say the least likely play for talking about food is the one that I love to talk about food in the most.
Well, I find this collection absolutely fascinating. I think that it opens up an absolutely new dimension for reading Shakespeare. And on the other hand, it also connects Shakespeare to modern times. Of course, it's not that necessary to do that, but because we all know that Shakespeare is fathomless and we can read Shakespeare many times and we'll discuss it and we'll discover new things. But on the other hand, this culinary dimension really puts him in some different light, and it adds some new other aspects which probably were dismissed or were ignored at some stages. And I think the closing chapter of this collection somehow ties Shakespeare to modern times: Room for Dessert, Sugared Shakespeare, and the Dramaturgy of a Dwelling. And there are some mentioning of some modern technologies in that essay as well.
Yeah, I think that's very true. That I certainly hope that this book helps kind of galvanize a new way of thinking about Shakespeare. I mean, there's nothing really new in Shakespeare, as you say; it's all been said. But it's about reframing, and it's about connecting the context of Shakespeare's time to the context of our own time, and thinking about ways in which the two can have a conversation, right? So I very much hope, and that's partly why I do really like that final essay, because Julia Lepton is really so adept at connecting contemporary design technologies and culinary technologies with Shakespearean technologies, and thinking about the ways in which there are, you know, very distinct connections, very powerful ways of thinking across that time gap to how there's a kind of humanist, post-humanist development mm-hmm. of ways of thinking about food that start with Shakespeare's time, I think. So the whole volume is attempting to say, basically, hey, there's this really interesting thing, both in Shakespeare studies and more largely in literary studies, mm-hmm. that we have only just begun to think through. And we in Shakespeare studies want to be on the forefront of that thinking. And we're showing that, yeah, we have several essays in here. There could be many more. There are many more. I know wonderful people who have been writing on this topic now. It seems like it's finally reaching a point where we can think of it as something that's really valuable, to make a concerted effort to make some connections that have not yet been made mm-hmm. about our own world and its relationship to Shakespeare.
Do you have any other culinary projects in mind?
The project I'm working on right now is a book that takes some of the ideas about the relationship between humans at the table, which we've been talking in this interview about the culinary. We haven't used the word commensality or the commensal, which is the word that social scientists use to talk about the relationships between humans, among humans at the table. And so my next book is going to be specifically about the way in which commensality works in literary texts all across genres and periods. So mm-hmm. I'm going to start with how Plato got us into this mess and move up to contemporary discourses about food and writing that are helping shape policy now. So it's very much based in this work, but it hopefully will open it up to some clear questions that broaden the state of the field.
Well, good luck on your new project.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this fascinating collection, and thank you so much for a wonderful conversation.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.